My name is Jeff Tabone, a member here at the church. Good morning. As Father Ben has mentioned today is Rogation Sunday. If you're unfamiliar with Rogation Sunday, it's the time in the church calendar, and appropriate seasonally, when we celebrate the giftedness of creation, the goodness of creation, and the way in which God makes himself known throughout all of creation. So in this Sunday, we recognize God as creator, and likewise, we recognize our relationship to him as creatures, right? Being born of God, creatures with finite limitations, and we're dependent on him. We're dependent on him to sustain us and to lead us towards lives of flourishing. So the word rogation comes from a Latin verb, rogare, meaning to ask. And our Book of Common Prayer instructs us as follows, that our rogation days, the next 3 days leading up to Ascension Day, are especially devoted to asking God's blessing on our agriculture and on our industry, right? Asking God's blessing on our labor and the work in which we work out. And it's an interesting posture to have this Easter season, to ask. It points towards something other than ourselves that we are dependent on, something other than our own capacities and abilities. So, this Rogation Sunday, this season, maybe it's a season as you are finishing up your academic year, what are you asking for? What are you dependent on? In today's collect, we ask God to pour into our hearts such love towards him, that we, loving God in all things and above all things, may obtain his promises, which exceed all that we can desire. It's a striking similarity to our gospel passage in John 15. Are we asking God for his love to be poured into our hearts? Are we asking God that we might love him above all things? Or, if you're following with the Book of Common Prayer, the following prayers for the next few rogation days, we ask the following, that your gracious providence may give and preserve to our use the harvests of the land and the seas, and may prosper all who labor and gather them, that we who are constantly receiving good things from your hand may always give thanks. It's a prayer helping us lean into a grateful disposition, a posture of gratitude. Are we asking God and praying in such a way that we recognize him as the one who is giving us these things? In early church history, when life was more intimately connected to the land and agriculture, when our culture was more keenly aware of human frailty, the church commonly used this time to ask God for protection against plague, against pestilence. There is a keen awareness of their dependency on God being actively present in the cultivation of crops. So I'm drawn to this connection on Rogation Sunday and how it reminds us of our dependency on God, not just for a few things, but for all things. This past year, I've been reading a book by Norman Wirzba, who works at Duke Divinity. The book's title is This Sacred Life. Probably the best book I've read in the past year. So if you're looking for a good book, This Sacred Life by Norman Wirzba. And he focuses a lot on the connections between theology and agriculture. So Wirzba, being a farmer himself, shares that he thinks for kind of our current state of affairs, the modern, contemporary Western individual, he says it's actually really, really hard and difficult for us to understand Scripture. And it's largely because we are so unfamiliar and disconnected from the agrarian way of life, from farming, from planting. And all those themes are so often found throughout the Bible. So unlike the people of Israel, we're pretty far removed from cycles of planting, cultivating, reaping, weeding, harvest, that we lose much within the biblical allegories. If you think even of today's passage in John 15, when was the last time you grafted something into a vine? Or let alone pruned a vine, for that matter? Or maybe even saw a vine? I don't know. But as we get removed from the natural world, we lose something within the biblical imagery and biblical allegories within Scripture. But Wurzba, in his book, The Sacred Life, has a couple quotes I think that are helpful for us to maybe lean into Rogation Sunday with some new understandings and be reminded of our dependency. He says this first: gardens are foundational settings for understanding what a human being is. So gardens are foundational settings for understanding what a human being is. Now, to be fair, I'm not much of a gardener. The most things I plant is usually grass to replace the holes in my yard that my dog has dug. And growing up, when I was gardening, my mom had a garden that shared with a neighbor. And typically, much to her frustration, anytime she was out working in the garden, like watering it, I was getting in the way in the hose, you know? Now, you know, you fast forward 25 years or so, and that's exactly what Nate, my son, does to me. Some watering grass. It just happened yesterday. So that's about my extent of gardening. But I think there is something we all could probably relate to, the way in which we've maybe tried to attempt to grow something and wanted to ensure that the environment in which it grew was conducive to its flourishing, right? Is it conducive for your plants to thrive? And that's really hard. That could be really difficult at times, depending on weather, depending on seasons, depending on raccoons, depending on pestilence, depending on deer. But we strive to be attentive to these places. And I think that's what Wurzba is drawing our attention to. In contrast, say, to the typical imagination where humans are strong, resilient, independent, we see humans, when we think about this garden analogy, we're reminded that now we actually have limitations. We have limitations. We're fragile. We're rooted. But more so, we're dependent. We're very dependent on so many countless things. So many countless things going well today. And often we overlook these things. So a quick thought experiment, just think about yourself. How many things had to go right for you today for you to be here this morning? Or let alone think about how many things had to go right for you this past week for you to be here this morning? I know mostly all of us drove, so just stepping back, big picture, some point in time, some crude oil had to be drilled out of some foreign soil, shipped wherever, refined, and then transported to some Grant County gas station, where then you were able to then pump it into the engine of your car and arrive here today. And even that transaction of getting it from the gas station required you to labor and work and earn some currency somewhere, right? We could unpack these things in a real spider web of intricacies. But I use that example as a reminder of just what are you dependent on? So many things that often go unobserved. And that's just transportation. You think about your shelter, you think about your food, you think about your health, you think about your ability to flourish as an individual. What are you dependent on as it comes to that? And I think when we are mindful of our dependency, whether that be on God, on creation, or our community, gardens are good templates to be reminded of our creaturely limitations. Another Wurzba quote, I think, that is helpful to unpack this connection between gardens and humans, he says this. He says, people are rooted, finite, needy, and dependent beings, drawing their inspiration, sustenance, and fulfillment from God's animating power that moves from the soil throughout the whole of creation. Now, here's a quick turn. I love how Wurzba reminds us of our limitations, but that we're able to flourish, that we're able to thrive as we lean into God's gracious power. It's a helpful reminder for where we stand in this cosmos. We're not lost. We're not utterly alone. And arguably, the more we recognize our finitude, the more we recognize our dependency, the more likely we will lean into Rogation Sunday with a posture of asking God to provide all the more fervently. So with this theme of dependency, I'd like us to turn to Acts 17. So it's in your bulletin there. And Acts 17 presents us with one of Paul's most famous sermons to the Greeks. Standing in the Areopagus, he appeals to the men of Athens, and he calls their attention to the unknown God. And I find it interesting that the men of Athens here they have an altar for the unknown God, and it depicts a people who are continuing to search for truth and continuing to seek for transcendence. And even though their temples were adorned with idols, they knew something else was needed to offer congruence and coherence within their lives. So in the rhetorical fashion of ancient Greece, Paul meets them in their searching and lays out an argument for who this unknown God is. So I'm going to start in verse 23, Paul's response to these men. He says, "What therefore you worship is as unknown, I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth." And he goes on, he does not dwell in temples, but let's pause right there. The God who made the world and everything in it. First, Paul is affirming God as creator. The God who made the world and everything in it. St. John Chrysostom, in commenting on Acts 17, reminds us that this creator, it's a mark of divinity. So Paul is setting up his argument for who this God is by marking God's divinity, by affirming God's divinity, by ascribing to God that God is creator. And do we not confess this every Sunday during our Nicene Creed? And a line easy to kind of skim over as we jump into the rhythms of our recitation of the Creed. We believe in one God, Father Almighty, the maker of heaven and earth. Every time we recite the Creed, we're ascribing to God, Him, the distinction of Him being a creator. Every Sunday we affirm this, God, the maker, the God who's made the world and everything in it. Next, it's important, Paul affirms that God, as creator, is self-sufficient. God is self-sufficient. And this is really helpful because it helps distinguish God, that Paul is drawing the men of Athens' attention to, in contrast to the other gods that are out there that they were worshiping. We see this in verses 24 to 25, Paul preaches, God does not live in temples made of man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. Right? God is self-sufficient. He doesn't need us. He's not dependent on us. And unlike the false gods of the ancient world or the false gods of our modern contemporary world, let's put that out there as well, his attributes don't change according to the way in which we worship him. God is not temperamental. I think this is incredibly freeing for us as we recognize our dependency on who this God is. And finally, Paul turns his argument away from a statement about God and makes a statement about God's relationship to humanity, God's relationship to us. In verse 25, Paul says this, "Since God himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything." Life and breath and everything. I think that about sums up everything we need to thrive and flourish. Life and breath and everything. So hence we have this stark contrast between a self-sufficient creator, God, who lacks nothing, in contrast to us being creatures who are finite, who are limited, who are dependent. The source of our life is not internal to us, as though we could conjure up by our own powers our ability to thrive and flourish. But no, they're external, right? The source of our life is dependent, aside from our own individual vitality and strength. I appreciate, too, how Paul emphasized God himself gives. Paul is highlighting a particular attribute of God's character. Acts 17:25 distinctively marks God as one who gives. So if it is God who gives life, then the life we receive is a gift. And the nature of this gift is marked by generosity and goodness. God gives good gifts. In Iwu's Honors College, we like to remind our students, and that's where I work, so it's, I'm not trying to plagiarize here, but we like to remind our students that God did not merely create the physical world and then step away, all right? But rather, his transcendent goodness pervades creation and giving it existence and life. And the physical world then becomes the sanctuary of God's glory. So when we're thinking about this gift, it's not like, here you go, step away. But no, God's goodness pervades this creation. And that's where we are then able to be reminded that it's God's goodness that animates all that we see and encounter on a daily basis. And we're reminded that God is ceaselessly at work in all the things he has created. Just the other day, we were driving down the road through some country roads here in Grant County, and Noel says, God created everything outside, but did he create everything inside as well? You know, I was trying to make this distinction. I'm like, well, as you know, everything got kind of inside our house. Noel comes from resources outside of our house. So yeah, sure, you know. So the thoughts of a six-year-old, I guess. But this is helpful for us. Pastor and theologian William Willimon instructs what Paul's doing here in Acts 17. He's laying out a natural theology. So I appreciate this. He's not laying out a systematic account. He's not giving these philosophical proofs. But what he's saying, he's appealing to their experience of the natural world. Hence, it's a natural theology. Willimon reminds us that often observations of the natural world are forerunners of our faith. I'd be curious, has your faith ever been encouraged or strengthened just by observing the natural world? Maybe it's the beauty of this world. Maybe perhaps it's the fine tuning of this world. Just the other day, I was out working in the yard, and there was such a cool and gentle breeze. And in my heart, I'm just like, man, God, thanks so much for this. You know, respite during a hard day's work, you know, when you're outside. But it's just like, what goodness in creation that we live in a world where there are small, gentle breezes that cool us off. I think what also is fascinating within our understanding of this creator God is that he defies the logic of creation. He's so enmeshed within his creation, so present, that he has the ability to defy the logic of this creation, which he has the ability to resurrect the dead. It contradicts the created order. But this is what Paul reminds us in 31. It's by this resurrection, by the righteousness of this man whom God has appointed, we have assurance. And I find this to be a rather compelling point to Paul's argument. I think I used to read Acts 17 as kind of thinking like, oh yeah, God reveals and every, you know, the lost will find some internal moral compass. Maybe similar to, say, Romans 1, where Paul's highlighting that, yeah, even though they knew God, they didn't honor him. But I think what's particular, so for me, I might skim over the argument in 17, 23 to 29 and just jump down to 30, where Paul's calling the men of Athens to repent. Right? Be aware of that internal moral compass. But I think what the prior verses, they paint a more compelling vision of how God generally reveals himself to humanity, particularly those who are lost. It's an awakening to the giftedness of this life, in that we're finite, limited creatures dependent on something or someone other than ourselves. And I think first and foremost, it's a posture of humility, that we recognize our temporal, fragile lives are held, sustained, and nourished by a loving God. And what good news is that? That our dependency is not on some idol or false character responsive to us, contingent on the way in which we worship, but a God whose character is one that's gracious, loving, good, a God whose character is self-sufficient and gives us all of life, all life, breath, and everything. I imagine it's fair to say many most of us are in a different place than Paul's audience at this time. I imagine most of us have found this unknown God and know him intimately. So I'm curious then in ways in which Paul's exhortation to the crowd could be relevant to us, could be a helpful reminder. I think personally, I believe our dependency on God takes on new meanings and new depths when we can move from this idea of dependency in the abstract and recognize our dependency in real and concrete ways. Gifts in the abstract bear way less weight on our imagination than gifts we receive in physical ways. A brief example. Previously, I worked at Spring Arbor University, and there's this long-standing tradition that every fall, I mean, we're talking 30 plus years, they'd bus all freshman students to Northern Michigan, to Mancelona, to this place called Cedar Bend Farm. And freshman students would be there from Thursday to Sunday. Cedar Bend Farm, a beautiful farm that was then transitioned into a retreat center. So while there, you know, it was kind of freshman orienteering, but then kind of colonial era chores. Why they needed to do that, I don't know. But colonial era chores, they go on a canoe trip down this beautiful Jordan River, which usually ended up students in the river in November, which never was good. They also would have an overnight, you know, kind of in the woods where they had to make a shelter. But this Cedar Bend weekend always culminated in killing two chickens, slaughtering two chickens, and then having chicken dinner afterwards. So maybe Taylor students are like, wow, I'm glad we didn't go to Spring Arbor, right? Not ready for that. So killing the Cedar Bend chickens was always a point of discussion for freshmen. Many had never slaughtered an animal in their life, and most had never been so close to confronting where their food comes from. So prior to the time, students had to sign up for different roles, right? Some would, maybe a student or two would hold down the chicken, other students would clean the chicken, defeather it, pull its guts out. There's always one student that got to swing the hatchet. Okay, and as you might imagine, there is two extremes to the students and their approach to how they came across this experience. One being, you know, the macho guy approach, and I think probably they're often overcoming or trying to overcompensate their own insecurities for killing an animal. But they fought over who got to, you know, chop the head off, and they cheer when this headless chicken was running around, and you know, you have blood spurting out of its neck. That was just severed, and you're like, okay, this is problematic. The other approach, maybe the more sensitive approach, the student that was in denial about the frailty of life, in denial about our dependency on these things, they would typically hide their face. They'd refuse to eat the chicken dinner afterwards. A lot of times they cried, there were tears. And there'd also be like a lot of public statements about the ethics of killing chickens. And how they were not like, they often like kind of postured themselves as being more virtuous, that they weren't complicit within the murder of these chickens. You know, so it was very sometimes nauseating. But because the irony of it is like 24 to 48 hours earlier, all these students were like chowing down on chicken tenders from the student center, right? Or like driving to Mancelona, they're ordering like 20-piece chicken nuggets from McDonald's. And I know that's probably questionable whether that's chicken or not. But it's still like there's this disconnect between the gift and what's going on. There's a disconnect between their dependency on chickens. Gifts in the abstract, like maybe deboned, skinless chicken breasts that are conveniently packaged on styrofoam and wrapped in plastic, bear less weight on our imaginations than gifts we receive in tangible and physical ways, such as fruit and vegetables that we grow, or animals that we butcher for our own subsistence and provision. So perhaps Rogation Sunday reminds us that it'd be wise to attend more intentionally to the natural world, to grow more cognizant of the ways in which we are dependent. We can strengthen our awareness of God acting, moving, and gifting us our life and breath just by being intentional. And arguably, most of us will never slaughter an animal, though I'm sure Stassens always welcome help with slaughtering their lambs, or chickens for that matter, if you're interested, if you want to see it, you know. Talk to Steve or Annika. And many of us probably will not grow fruits and vegetables. And I don't want to, you know, try to make any arguments here because, right, there's a lot of pragmatics we're concerned with. I live in a house with a ton of trees and shade. I have no good room for a garden. But yet, how might we attune our intentionality to the food we consume to being good and gracious gifts? How can we move beyond an abstract creed of I believe in God, maker of heaven and earth, to a more tangible attention to how this God pervades creation and reveals himself to us through it? As our the Rogation prayer reminds us, how might we cultivate a grateful disposition that we recognize the goodness of the gifts that sustain us and the complex ways in which we are dependent on God, his creation, and the community around us, which helps us flourish? Maybe Rogation Sunday reminds us that perhaps one of the best spiritual disciplines you could do in this day and age of being alienated from the land is just buy a house plant, attend to it, nurture it, be its biographer, right? Cataloging the ways in which it grows, changes, develops. Be mindful of it. And perhaps in such a simple exercise, we too can grow into the deep and abiding assurance that truly it is God who gives life and breath and everything to all mankind. And that, as Paul reminds us in verse 27, he's actually not very far from us. And may this truth remind us of our dependency on his good and gracious gifts, out of which may our hearts overflow with gratitude. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.